Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 207, featuring Joe Farrell of Tangerine. And I have known Joe for many, many years. Tangerine is his new company. Actually, not so new. I guess it's been around for a while, which you can go check out tangerineapps.com. That's, again, tangerineapps.com. And there's a story why it's Tangerine Apps and not Tangerine. But go check out tangerineapps.com to see all the cool stuff that they're doing there. But like I said, I knew Joe back when I was at Digital Domain, and he and I worked on several projects together. Really creative guy. But his history goes way, way further back and way further away. Back in Sydney, he was an in-between artist, traditional in-between drawing artist for Disney TV stuff that he was doing there. And that's pretty darn cool. And we talk about that for a little bit. But we also talk about his later career, which I'm not going to get too much into because I'm going to let him do that. But I want to make sure you guys note one thing. When he was working at Scanline, was nominated for an Oscar for Hereafter, which is the Clint Eastwood film Hereafter, which is absolutely incredible work. Really, really great work. So anyway, a lot to talk about with Joe, including some of the amazing work he's doing now at Tangerine, including the work he did for the Olympic Committee, which is fascinating. But you guys just listen to the podcast. There's a lot of cool stuff to go into. I don't really have many announcements. I just have a lot of excitement right now. I'm going to explain that in a little bit. We are in the middle of transforming this room, which I'm recording the intro in, which is our podcast room. And a lot of thanks goes to Kristen Gwynn, who is our office manager, who has been helping me tirelessly come up with all the things we need to make this room really cool, including the fact that we're going to get a custom-made table just for the podcast and some professional broadcast mounts and all those things. So really, really exciting. And it's going to be really great. I'm so excited, and I can't thank Kristen enough for making this place a really great place for the podcast. The other good thing is that I am actually using this room for more than one podcast. The CG Garage podcast obviously is what I do a lot of while I'm Chaos, while at Chaos Group. But and after hours, thanks to permissions from Vlado and Peter Mitev, our CEO, and Lon Gross, my more immediate boss, I'm able to, they said it was perfectly okay for me to record Martini Giant episodes here. And for those of you who actually have listened to the podcast, you guys know that I do these Martini Giant episodes with Dan Thron. So now we have broken that off and made it its own podcast, its own independent podcast. And they're letting me record those episodes, after hours here, which is great. Definitely go check it out. We would love to get more listeners and letting us know what you feel. If you enjoyed the episodes I've done with Dan Thron, we did a Mad Max episode, a Star Wars episode, we did a La La Land episode, a whole bunch of different things. Anyway, it'd be great to get new listeners. So go to martinigiant.com to check that out. We're available on anything you listen to your podcasts on. So just, if you're on iTunes or Pocket Cast or Google Play Podcast, whatever it is, just look up Martini Giant and we will be available. And just subscribe, like, share, the whole thing. Would love to hear more about it. Just let us know what you think and we'd love to hear that. All right, guys, that's all I've got. Hopefully you guys will enjoy this fantastic episode with Joe Farrell of Tangerine.
Welcome to another CG Garage, where the Chaos Group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fernell.
Yeah, well, I did my, I wanted to work in films forever. Yeah. Actually, since I was 12, according to my stepmom. She's like, you knew what you were going to do when you were 12.
And where was this?
I started in Sydney, Australia.
Right. Yep.
And It was funny. I was listening to a podcast you had the other day about a guy who did traditional animation on Lion King.
Yeah, yeah. That was just released, that one.
Yeah.
Right, right, yeah.
So I started at Disney.
Really?
As a traditional animator.
Wow.
Working on the other side of the world.
Okay.
I worked at the Disney Studios in Sydney.
Uh-huh.
There were about 300 or 400 people there.
Okay.
And they had like this sort of intern thing happen, and they would actually allow you to sit this test.
Uh-huh.
And I did graphic design at weirdly my old old primary school.
Uh-huh.
And then I decided to sit this test, and I actually got in. So they took 4 people out of 1,000 entrances.
Okay.
And then you would go in and you'd do this drawing test.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would train you to be an in-betweener. And so I became an in-betweener working at Disney. But it was funny that I heard that gentleman talking about traditional animation. I'm like, oh, that reminds me of me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's cool. We've actually had a couple of Disney or traditional animators. Brenda Chapman, she's been on the podcast. She was the director on Brave. And
right.
So
right,
right. She came from that thing. What's it like being an in-betweener?
Wow.
It's a lot of drawing.
You know, you get into it for a passion with drawing, and you don't necessarily come out of it with a passion for drawing.
Right. That's what I'm getting at. Yeah.
I had a lot of passions and basically a lot of creative juices flowing, and I worked with them for about a year. I worked on a television show called Duck Days. Australia had several traditional animation studios.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people don't know this, but Australia was a huge hub of traditional animation. Hanna-Barbera's was based mainly out of Australia in Sydney.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah, they had like 300 or 400 artists working in St. Leonard's there.
Wow.
And they were kind of crazy. They were like the golden days of television. They did all Scooby-Doo.
Yeah.
The Flintstones. And when I say all, they did significant
amounts of it. Right.
And it was all animated out of there. But you'd hear all these crazy stories of all the
Is it kind of like The Simpsons in Korea kind of stuff, or?
I don't know. I actually don't know. I guess back in the day when Warner Brothers or Hanna-Barbera's were sort of looking expanding, they would reach out to similar kind of cultures, you know. So
got it.
I think, you know, Australians, they speak the same language.
Yep.
They think it's very similar.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps it was something like that. But I honestly don't know why it was so big. But so Hanna-Barbera's was there and Disney were there, but they did a lot of television work, unlike the gentleman the other day,
right,
who was from Florida, where they did feature work and stuff. But so we mainly did sort of the television stuff that mm-hmm. was going around. But I decided to leave there and went and worked for, ironically, the competition, Warner Brothers.
Oh,
and,
wow.
There was a
in Sydney.
In Sydney, yeah. So I my father was in the television business, and mm-hmm. so I would do sort of work experience. I don't know if you guys over here did work experience. When you're in sort of year 10, you get the opportunity to go and visit businesses.
Okay.
And when you visit a business, you sort of, you know, hang out with them for a week. And I did two things. One of them was with this show called Countdown, which nobody here would know, but it was very much like MTV. But no, actually more like you know, those sort of live bands and the screaming girls where the Beatles would be.
It's that kind of
a show.
Yeah, so more like Ed Sullivan.
Kind yeah, of? Yeah, but okay. Like sort of in the
more
80s.
Modern. In the 80s.
Yeah.
Like an 80s version of Ed Sullivan.
Yeah,
80s. Was it an Australian show?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. It was called Countdown. It was actually huge. There was something about Australia was like this far off land that nobody really knew about, but
right.
It was huge for huge bands. So
right.
They, you know, Elton John, Madonna, all of these guys would go there and they'd do these specials and concerts and they'd go to this show and this show had a huge following. It was really successful. Anyway, I did a week with those guys running around, and I got to interview U2, and B.B. King was doing the tour with them.
That's
so
awesome.
I didn't say so much do the interview as I lay on the ground and held the microphone while the guy who did the interview asked the question.
Right.
So I should clarify that.
And but you were present.
I was present,
yes. Very close.
I got to look up at B.B. King's nostrils
right.
Because, just due to the – they couldn't find a nice little mount like this. They used a human mount. And then the other thing I did was I worked at a company that one of those animators that I mentioned before from Hanna-Barbera's, he left and started his own company. And he was, by far one of the most amazing people I've ever come across in my career. His name was Peter Lushtwitz, and he was the nicest, caring, and the most open person I've ever come across, who basically was an animation genius.
Okay.
And he personally knew Bill Hanner and those guys because they realized that he was like truly something special. And I went and did a week with him, and I did everything from slit scan optical printing to Steadicam stuff and so on. And I, at that point, I was in for life. And
wow.
That was my goal in life, was to do what those guys did.
Awesome.
Yeah.
All right. So you basically said, okay, I'm going to actually stop drawing and start to get into the more interesting technical stuff, I guess.
Yeah. Well, at the time, you may be familiar with Flame was written by some Australians.
Yes. Okay.
And was it the Discrete Flame guys? They wrote it in Sydney, I think.
Okay.
And at the time when I left those traditional animation companies and pursued a career in computer graphics, because that was something I had also dabbled in a lot.
Right.
And so went and worked for a couple of companies, but one of them used to be called Apocalypse Now. Uh-huh. It then turned into Digital Pictures, and they was this crazy building. I don't know what your can or can't say on your podcast, but
you can say anything you want.
they designed the building with the height of the 80s post-production in mind.
Right. So like a lot of cocaine and all that kind of stuff.
The bathrooms were deliberately built with mirrored shelves that were perfectly at nostril height.
Right.
And I know that when I did get a job there, I ended up working as a HAL operator, which was part of the Quantel systems.
Uh-huh.
So I became a HAL operator, and they had two phones. There were two speed dials on that phone. One of them worked, the other one didn't. Okay. They would go to dealers. Just
right.
So I was told.
Right.
I've never personally used them.
Wow. Was the days, man. It was like I think that was the lure of the, you know, commercial work and Flame was like being that guy who's like got the big band behind you, and they're all like eating lobster and doing cocaine. And
they were rock stars. There was one particular guy at Digital Pictures who I always admired and looked up to, and he was almost slightly older than me, I think.
Right.
Alex, his name was, and he went over to New York, and now I'm not sure what he does, but Alex Catchpool, his name was, and he was the rock star. And he was treated like a rock star.
Right.
They would charge him out about $1,200 to $1,300 an hour.
Right, yep.
And but he was quite frankly worth $1,200 to $1,300 an hour.
I've seen it.
And I would watch him work 16, 18 hour days. One point we did a big ident for one of the big channels back there.
Yeah.
And there was these two outrageous creative guys that would come in from the studio, and they would do an ident was quite significant, with about 6 weeks worth of work. You would basically rebrand. It's like rebranding NBC.
Right.
So take the Peacock logo and rebrand it across everything. That's sports, drama, everything like that. Then you get all the talent together, and they do that silly thing where they run around on a whitewash background and they do sort of funny things and hold the logo and all that sort of stuff.
And then you got to do lower thirds. You got to
all that sort of crazy stuff. And I was supporting both the Flame artist, the Fire artist, and goodness knows what else we had running the facility. And he would be doing 16, 17 hour days. And at one point we were doing that last 1 or 2 day push. And I remember the client just sort of saying, you know, I'd walk in and they basically had opened up the briefcase, and inside the briefcase was whatever was going to take to get the job done. And they were like, "Joe, would you like to partake?" And I was like, "Oh, I'm good. Thank you. here are those elements you needed."
Right.
Bye.
Yeah. Those were the days. I mean, I think there were still some people when I started in visual effects in the early 2000s. It was still some of that attitude that was going on. But I noticed that the new blood became a little bit different, you know?
Yeah.
A little bit different. And it's interesting that Mike Seymour must have been doing some Flame work around there.
Yeah, weird. Actually, I actually went and I went back after – I went up to Canada for 4 years, and I went back for a little little stint and sort of caught up with some friends and did a little bit of work. And I actually worked at a company called Cottage, which was where Mike Seymour,
right?
I think he was co-owner or something of it. And I did a little bit of thing with those guys. But yeah, right. I came across him a little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, back then, it used to be called Apocalypse Now before Digital Pictures, this place that was custom designed for doing weird things in it. There was an editor there called Roy, and he worked in one of those old traditional edit bays.
Right.
And that particular edit bay had been privy to about 7 or 8 of the biggest bands and the biggest music videos of all time.
Uh-huh.
He did David Bowie's China Girl.
Wow.
Madonna would come and they'd mix the concert. So upstairs they would redo all the sound and stuff. So she would come in with all her entourage.
Right.
And they would sit up the back and they'd remix all the concert, because they'd go to Sydney. They'd do this huge performance at like the Sydney Cricket Ground.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'd remix it, or they'd do like a music video.
Right.
And so he'd tell me about all sorts of crazy stories, and I was just in awe. I was like, oh my God, it's just the best.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. I mean, there is a lure to that. That's interesting. But how long did you do that for? How long were you sort of?
I was in Sydney for about 7 years, I'd say, before I decided that Sydney was not big enough for me.
Okay.
And so I wanted to work in films, and to work in films was pretty hard in Sydney.
Right.
D Film had just done The Matrix.
Right.
Down there, and I think they were using the first iteration of Flame, or they had an actual compositing software. I can't remember what it was called.
Okay.
And so I tried to work there, but that didn't work out. And so, you know, if you work in commercials and you work in films, there was very much a separation between the two.
Sure.
It's very difficult to combine those two, maybe probably because of egos and goodness knows what.
Yeah.
And so got an offer to work in television in Canada. And so left up there. And
okay.
Went and worked up there for 4 years. My girlfriend at the time came with me, and we got married up there, and we did a lot of television.
Okay. Where in Canada? In Montreal or?
No, Vancouver.
In Vancouver.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I was there from 98 to 2002.
Okay.
Was when we left. So way before any of the work that's being done up there was.
Right. But, right. And it was a lot of TV back then, I think, right?
Yeah. And pretty prominent too. Basically MGM owned a lot up there, the MGM lot, which it's down on Boundary or something like that. It's way down the end of Vancouver. They had built that studio, and they had done a lot up there. They started way back in the day, and I was working with a lot of the guys that were doing like The Love Boat and MacGyver.
Really?
So MacGyver was done up there.
Okay.
And then, of course, X-Files. So between yes. X-Files, MacGyver, Love Boat, all these things that you didn't even know were shot in Vancouver.
Right.
They had been up there for 10
years. And this was, you're right, it was before all the subsidies and all that stuff, right?
Yeah. And that's the funny thing is I've watched
You can see it now. You can look at old, the old X-Files and like, yeah, that pretty much looks like Vancouver.
Yeah. I can pick a Vancouver show within about 2 or 3 seconds. I'm like, oh, look, the GVRD.
Right.
So we actually had a great time up there, and then I was just, you know, all right, well, that's enough for television for me.
Okay.
I wanted to come and work in films, and actually ironically couldn't get a job back in the States, so ended up going back to Australia and worked on a couple of films there.
Interesting.
And then got hired at DD.
Okay, so how long were you in Australia, just for like a year or two?
Yeah, less than a year. Yeah, about 9 months or
okay.
something. Went back there, and we thought we were done. But in my mind, and I think my wife knew, she was like, yeah, I don't think we're here for very long.
Okay. Yeah. And your wife is Australian as well?
Yeah. Okay. Am I your first Australian on the show?
No. Mike Seymour's been on.
Oh, Mike. Right. Okay.
I think he may be. No. Ian Fales has also been on.
Oh, yeah.
So, cool. Yeah, I've had a couple of Australians.
All right, well,
a couple of Australians, yeah.
Many of us then.
But yeah, it's cool.
Hopefully I haven't lost my accent.
No, no, it's still very strong.
Okay,
it's good.
Yeah.
Not too strong.
Yeah. Well, that's the funny thing. When I came over here and eventually got the job at DD and was lucky enough to get some lead roles in some of those things, I realized it took me 2 years, I'd say a solid 2 years, before I was able to converse with the team in a way that they completely understood what I was saying.
Really?
Yeah.
You think so?
Yeah, big time. Yeah, a lot of the times.
It's not as bad as Rory McLeish. Remember Rory? Scottish guy. He was on the Lightning team.
Oh, yes, yes,
His accent was very, very strong.
I actually understood him more than I understood the Americans.
Right. It took me a while to understand Rory, but which, you know, just because I'm a stupid American and I don't understand those things.
I wouldn't say that.
But after about, you know, I think it was maybe a year before I was like, and a lot of people are still struggling with Rory. And, you know, the thing that was interesting about Rory is that he was a little bit shy about speaking because he knew that a lot of people couldn't understand his accent.
Oh, I see.
But he wrote beautiful emails, really, really funny ones too. So we all loved Rory's prose. That were really hilarious.
And you can't see the accent in the email.
No, you can't. You can't. And you realize like, oh yeah, his English is actually exactly the same as my English. It just sounds different.
Yeah. Oh, he's been speaking like that all along. If only he walked around with like subtitles underneath.
Yeah, no, I loved Rory. He had the greatest sense of humor. Greatest sense of humor. It was really funny. So you went to DD in 2002 or three?
Two or three, yeah.
What was your first film there?
Peter Pan.
Peter Pan. Okay. So I guess I was on the tail end of me working on Day After Tomorrow.
Yeah.
And you were on the Peter Pan show.
Yeah. I went on the Lucky Show.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
My friend, basically I had another friend.
So with Hansi and all those guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
I got hired by Klaas.
Oh, okay.
So Klaas looked at my reel, apparently.
Compositing reel, I'm assuming.
Yeah. I sent a comp reel over. Actually, I had, Jason.
What were you compositing in? Jason is awesome. Yeah.
So Jason got the job to work on Day After Tomorrow.
Yes.
And he said,
I should have him on the podcast.
You should. Yeah. Yeah. More Australians. So Jason, I said to him, dude, I can't stay back here. Can you help me out? And he said, sure, I'll see what I can do. So he went and, you know, I sent the reel to him. And I think he personally handed it to somebody who said, I think I have somebody that'd like to have a look at it. So Klaas apparently took my reel and he had to walk across the street over to commercials and put it into a PAL DVD player.
Oh, my gosh.
Because I couldn't make an NTSC because, most of Australia thought NTSC was the silliest format on the planet.
It still is.
And so
never twice the same color.
Never twice the same color. I mean, 29 frames and worse resolution.
29.97. And there's a reason for that. Do you know what it is?
Who knows?
An interesting history. I'm going to educate our crowd on this.
Yeah.
So, I Love Lucy, right? Or whatever those shows were, black and white TV shows, were shot at 30 frames a second and broadcast at 30 frames a second because they were black and white broadcast. And when they developed color broadcast, they needed to be able to differentiate two different frequencies of the signal. Right.
What, in case your television was black and white?
In case your television was black and white or you had a black and white signal versus an NTSC color signal. Oh. So they changed the frequency slightly and therefore dropped a frame every 10th of or 100th of a frame in order to do that.
Yeah.
So that's what it became 29.97 in order to change the frequency slightly of the signal so there would be a difference between the color signal and the black and white signal.
Somehow, something tells me they could have come up with a better
solution. They could have come up with a better solution.
Because it caused
Since
so
film was
much
shot
grief.
At 24, you know.
It caused so much grief back in the other. I mean, basically, PAL's 25, which is 25. Also a little odd, but at least you got 25, 50. You know, it's close to
divisible.
Film.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, it's close to film. It's higher res. It's 720 by 576. Yep.
And then there was SACOM, but that was all in Europe, I think, right?
Well, it was the English or something, right?
The French and the English. No, maybe the English used it.
Never came across that. It was
But Europe was already like, Europe itself had a problem with PAL and SACOM. It was all that way. Yeah. And then NTSC is like, oh boy.
3-2 pull down. My God.
Yeah.
What a pain in the ass.
Right. So you had a reel on PAL, so they had to go across the street to play.
Yeah. So Klaas apparently went over there. I remember this only because he kept telling me, he's like, you know, Joe, I had to go across the street. That's my really bad Klaas impersonation. I had to go across the street to go and specially watch your reel. So you're very lucky that I hired you. And I'm like, oh, yes. No, thank you. That's very good.
Yes.
Anyway, I got to work with Klaas, and he is by far. You know, I mentioned Peter Lushtwitz is the animator that I look up to. There's only so many people that I look up to that I just like are godly to me.
Uh-huh.
And Klaas is the other one.
Awesome.
He is definitely somebody you should have on your podcast.
Yeah, great. I'll definitely put me in touch with him. I'd love to have him.
He is the funniest German I've ever come across. I hope he is German. Yeah, he's German, not Austrian. He is by far one of the funniest people and the most astounding visual effects artist I've ever come across.
Yeah, he's really, really good. It's awesome.
So joined DD and, you know, the rest is history. Was there for about 8 years and then Scanline for about 5 years. And now recently.
So wait, what shows were we on together? Because we were on you were on iRobot, right?
I was on iRobot. Yeah. I went on from Peter Pan to iRobot, Stealth for a while.
Yeah, so you and I were on that together.
Then I got put on the, I got known as the person that would do the 50% more mysterious work.
Yep.
And there was a lot of that.
Weird descriptions of things that you'd have to come up with.
Yeah. So I don't want to know what it is, but it's something. Oh, hang on.
That's all right.
I should have silenced that.
That's all right.
So I did a lot of that sort of work where the client would come in and they'd say, look, it needs to be something nobody's seen before, which, you know, most of it was. But
When they see it, they go, oh, too scary.
No, it needs to be more magical. And can you just kiss in about 20% more organic?
Right, yeah.
And you'd be like, sure.
Right. Or the ones I used to love was like, it needs to feel more blue, but not actually be more blue.
God. Luckily, I had the best training, you know, 7 years of commercial work where you're working in flames and the stress level of being an artist in a room with sometimes 9 non-speaking Japanese people that had flown in from Japan to work on master their thing. Right. And they'd have these 9 guys sitting in a row, and the one on the end was the only one that didn't speak English. He was the only one that was, he did speak English.
Right.
And he'd be like 50. Right. The rest are all sort of look like they're 20.
Right.
And I'd be talking to him all the time.
Uh-huh.
And then afterwards they said, you know, he's just the translator.
Oh, right.
The others are the clients. You might want to just sort of address them. And I'm like, oh, okay. So these 20-year-olds would come in and they'd have this, you know, from Nokia or something like that.
Right.
And those sorts of sessions would sort of teach you a lot about how to deal with 50% more mysterious.
Yeah. Or things being lost in translation, also. That's a challenge as well.
Yeah, body language. You learn to to comp by body language because they're all watching you, and you become a psychologist in a way.
Yes, and you're even just seeing their facial expressions and stuff.
Yeah, they would often be like, you know, gagging around, and they'd be sort of looking. But if you watched all of them, eventually you'd see 2 or 3 of them sort of like they'd sort of bump shoulders. They'd look at something, they'd comment on something, and you knew that you'd flicked past something, and they were pondered and responsible. And you could literally comp an entire commercial just by watching what they were doing.
Right,
and that teaches you a lot about, you know, working on a show.
Absolutely. I mean it's a different example, but you know, one of the things about my podcast, a lot of people say, oh, I'd love to do a podcast with you. It's like, well, are you in Los Angeles or are you going to be at this event or whatever? Because I always do them in person for the same reason, right? I want to read, what the person's saying, the conversation we're doing, what they're doing. And it makes a huge difference. You know, you get to interact with someone much more personal, and you get to make a connection if you can see what they're saying and how they're reacting to things. So it makes a big difference. And the same is true. I think you're right. You know, how many times have you gotten notes in an email about a comp or whatever you're doing?
Awful.
And it's the worst.
Awful.
Like, what do you mean by this? You know?
Yeah, I found that actually to be really, really difficult as time went on, you know, with the subsidies kicking into full ball.
Oh, my God, yeah.
So basically what happened is I became a VFX soup at Scanline, and I would, or DFXing or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And so I would often be souping the team up north.
Right.
And
but being it, down here,
but being right. here, yeah. Right. So you know, some of those initial shows I did. Battleship was the main one, where they had just built the northern facility, and there were like 10 of them up there,
right?
And doing some hard stuff, And but you know, you'd be down here in a cine sync, and you'd describe something, and you'd. I'm very much a waving my hands in the air sort of stuff. And I'm always giving direction with my hands.
Uh-huh.
You know? And so I'd be waving my hands around and they're like, oh, you're frozen. Did you want the shot to stop? I'm like, no. Okay. All right. I'll fly up. It'll be so much easier.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Literally a plane ticket can save you thousands of versions.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So definitely, I'm a huge fan. You know, with this modern technology and stuff, it's all good and great, but I'm always one for just simply just picking up the phone and dialing it, or then just coming over and seeing it.
There's something to be said about that for sure. I mean, I know for a fact that I, even though I don't like going to huge traveling a lot, it makes a huge difference to meet people in person. So I think it's an important part of it. And sometimes emails, you know, there's only like after about three or four emails, like, can we get on a phone? You know, let's at least get to that level, where we can have a conversation. So it does make a difference. So, okay. So you were at Scanline for, you said about seven,
just shy of it, I think.
Okay.
I was having a great time at DD, but then things started getting weird.
Right.
Which I know you guys have touched on.
We've discussed.
I don't need to discuss.
Well, there was a lot of changes that were going on, and sometimes those changes, there were other opportunities that were showing up. So I guess.
Yeah. I had the best, basically.
What was your last show there?
Well, at the end, I really sort of wasn't overly on shows. I became basically, Klaus and myself set up the visual effects art department.
Right.
Well, he was always the art department, but I begged and clawed my way and said, please, 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 can I join you?
Okay.
And so basically he shuffled over some, you know, some Beatles albums out of the way, and I managed to squeeze into the corner there from him. And the two of us became basically the visual effects art department. And I should clarify what that is, because being in the art department on a film is a very specific job.
And usually covered by unions.
Covered by unions and very, very tightly controlled by unions, to the point where you are absolutely not permitted to have an art directing title in your credits of the film.
Yes.
So we became visual effects concept artists, visual effects designers, visual effects supervising designers, everything you could possibly imagine.
Right.
We were the visual effects art department. And basically what your job was to clarify what 50% More Mysterious was.
Right.
It's basically a show consists of two kinds of work, in my opinion. There was the kind of work that was sort of set up and mechanical in its way. iRobot, Sunny needed a certain look.
Yep.
Yes, it's artistically driven, but it's very scientifically driven as well.
Yep.
And then there's
I remember those conversations with Jonathan Ekstad.
Yes. The science and the art. And I think DD walked that line nicely.
Mm-hmm.
But and that's the kind of work that, like, for instance, stealth, you know, the plane. You guys were talking about, you know, ray tracing the plane and things like that.
Right.
I don't come from that. I come very much from a splat paint up against the wall and see what happens.
Right.
And that works really well in commercials, works reasonably well in television. And then in big feature films, it has its place, but you have to find it, because otherwise you can rock the boat a little bit.
Well, the problem, I think, is that what you're hoping to do with the quote-unquote science of it is that you can be consistent.
Yes.
Right?
Consistency.
So if you're able to say, okay, we will base this many of the quote-unquote variables on scientific facts that you don't mess with this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, you can do the rest that way. Actually, I honestly think that the more we do technology the way we're doing it, you know, especially with ray tracing and the way we composite things right now and all that stuff, is really a great way to reduce the variables so that you can mimic much more closely live action actions, right? Like when you take a camera and you take a picture with a camera, it's acting on physics, you know, real life ray tracing. So having that, then your artistic point role behind the camera is not diminished. It's just that what you're doing is like you're placing lights and you're doing, you know, you're compositing the frame and you're worrying about your depth of field. And those are all things that you still have control over.
Yeah.
And doing that in CG is basically all we're doing now, is like, we remove all that. So now you can do it that way, which I think is valuable.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's amazing. What you can do now is almost like pull out of now that I run my own company, you can basically go, oh, you need hair? There. pick that, put that in and install it. There you go. We're doing here.
Right.
So all that work that's gone before to do that work that we were sort of developing at DD and working hard to do, you can just basically just pull off a shelf now. I mean, you need the artists to run it and so on. But but that's so amazing that you can do that now. So in a way, we've sort of evolved past that. Now we can actually go, all right, we know how to do a human or we know how to do hair. I mean, maybe we don't. But, you know, we'd like to think we can.
Yeah.
And we can now pull that off. And now we can be like, well, what do you want to do with the human? Well, I'd like to tell this story.
Right.
Whereas before, it was a lot of the time like, well, here's hoping we'll pull it off kind of thing.
You spend so much of your time just trying to make it even possible, right?
Yeah. I mean, so much of the work is like, you know, I must have been on 80% of the shows was trying to get it up to a level that was passable rather than actually saying, hey, look, we've got a show here where we're taking it from, we shot it fabulously and now let's make it insane.
Right. Yeah,
And so I've spent a lot of my career trying to sort of prevent that.
Right.
But then, so anyway, so this DD had this sort of two thing. It had basically these mechanical way of working with like Flags of Our Fathers, very mechanical in its way.
Okay.
Not a lot of, there is artistry in it and visuals and layouts and all that sort of stuff, but it's, you know, an explosion is an explosion. We roll out off a real explosion, now match it.
Yep.
And I worked on that one for a year, so I know it well. And the other one was like, you know, I then went over to a show which was almost 100% wacky, weird stuff, which was Aeon Flux.
Oh, my gosh.
And so I did Aeon Flux for, I don't know, a long time. And
you know what's strange about that movie is that I was just at the end of iRobot, and I wanted to be on Aeon Flux.
Right.
So much, and I heard about it because I loved the animation of it. I was just such a big fan, and I was begging to be on it. And then at that point, I ended up leaving, going to Sony when it was going on. But that must have been a tough show.
It kind of was. I mean, it honestly, I think everybody didn't like it except for me.
Really?
I actually really enjoyed that show. I got given a huge responsibility. I think it was lead compo or something. And we had a big team, had some amazing artists, had a team of about 20 or 30 compos working in our team. And I got the, boy, did I get the 50% more mysterious stuff.
Right.
I got the, oh God, where to start?
These were first time directors too, right?
Karen was a lady.
Right.
And she was hilarious because I got some funny stories there. I remember, privy to our previous comment about it's really good to get notes from a director when you're physically in the room from them.
Yes.
So when they're sort of like, you know, if they're, it's an angry note, you're like, ooh, okay.
Right.
Or it's a cash note that was flippant and thrown out there and maybe it's not true. Mm-hmm. And you're like, I know where you're coming from. I know how to answer it, but what you're telling me to do is wrong, but I know how to get you what you want.
Right.
You get that from being in the room.
So in an email, you don't.
Yeah. And so this show was so wacky, and if anybody's on the podcast seen Aeon Flux, it is the craziest movie ever. It's just full of female genitalia, the whole thing, and male genitalia actually.
Okay.
There's a giant floating. Anyway, I won't go into the details. Just watch the movie. but the film is so crazy, and the effects we were doing was so insane. Like these weird like time distortions. I think Brandon McNaughton, I think he was charged with these kind of weird, that the image just ripped in half and pulled apart and you would transport to these memory things. That stuff was crazy cool.
Right.
I was flying inside people's brains and neurons.
Yeah.
So figuring out how to fly through, and Jonathan Eggstad and I, Jonathan was rewriting code in Nuke to be able to do depth, basically
Z depth
rack focus in comp, because we just couldn't combine this in CG and put the Z defocus in, render it in.
It was too expensive back then, way too expensive.
Too expensive, too complex. We needed like 17 passes of neurons and brains, and you needed to comp all this stuff in there.
Right.
So basically we developed it all in comp.
Right. And this was a long time ago, obviously.
Yeah, I can't remember.
It's probably 2004 or 5.
5, 6, 6, something like that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So we were doing all that sort of stuff, and I had a blast. There was this other sequence where glowing glowing memories coming from a big black pond that go up to a giant blue ring that explodes, and she comes down wearing this white spandex outfit and spins upside down. And then at one point, there's this great actor walks into this giant floating male genitalia, right, floating above the city, and there's all these harp strings.
Okay.
And images appearing on these harp strings like DNA.
Uh-huh.
Just the craziest stuff. Anyway, to get an opportunity to do all this crazy stuff was so awesome.
Yeah.
I had fun.
Yeah, I had
fun, even though it was a hard show.
But
Karen wouldn't, the director wouldn't like any artists in the room, to the point where she actually almost got to the point, I think, where none of DD's staff at all were allowed into the room. She would watch the shots by herself and her team. And we made this joke that we would all listen to the door, and you know, she would tap dance the, you know, she'd mime the notes.
Why? I wonder what she.
She basically became so sensitive to. And this is what I believe.
Right.
It became so sensitive to watching the shots and giving notes that she didn't want anybody in the room.
Interesting.
And so that made it really difficult for us to go.
Yeah, I bet.
How do we address notes that it's Lisa and I remember? You know, I think Lisa Spence was on that one with.
Right.
Me.
Yeah. It was Lisa, but I'm sure. Nancy Bernstein was also helpful, I think, a little bit on that one, right?
I can't remember. It's been a long time. I wasn't too privy at the upper echelons at that point.
All right.
But, yeah.
I'm sure that was a challenge.
But, yeah.
All right. So let's I want to get make sure that we have time to talk about your new stuff. So you were at Scanline for 5 years, and then you decided to break off and do your own thing.
Yeah. I decided I'd sort of, in a weird way, I'd almost stopped learning. I stopped learning on a level that I have this insatiable desire to absorb as much as I possibly can.
Completely understand.
And it's slowed down to a trickle to the point where anything I was learning was just sort of, you know, just a 10% or 5% on what I was already doing in the pipeline of my day-to-day thing. And I decided to do something very radical, asked my wife's permission. Decided to go and start. I met a friend of mine, a business partner, and we set up a company to basically do app design.
Okay.
I'd never done an app. I'd never had a smartphone up until I started this company.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
When did you start a company?
14, the end of 13, 2014.
Wow, okay. Uh-huh.
So we're coming up 4.5 years now.
Wow.
And yeah, it's almost an accomplishment. I'm still around.
Yeah, that's a huge thing.
And so we set that up, and I wasn't too sure. I was like, oh, how do you set up a company? How do you start? Do you set up a business model? Do you set up a plan? Do you write a document and all that sort of stuff? Yeah, we didn't do any of that. We just sort of started it and started, you know, figuring out where to work. And I actually got a phone call a couple of weeks in by Rob Legato. We'd just done Wolf of Wall Street together.
Oh, right.
I supervised that at Scanline.
Yeah.
And we did two big sequences,
the boat crashing.
And the helicopters.
Yes.
All the helicopter work. And we did virtual production.
I think
production.
It's on the V-Ray reel.
Oh, is it? Yeah. So we did all that work.
Yep.
And I had a blast. It was a super awesome show. And working with Rob was great. And so he gave me a call and he said, can you come and help me out? The proverbial poop is hitting the fan on my present show.
Okay.
Please come along and help. And so I came along and hired a couple of my friends to go and do Jungle Book.
Right.
And so we did that. And that sort of kept – it was going to be like a short, like 2 to 3 month gig of just helping – while he shot, we post-vised and pre-vised and – put the shots together, took the blue screens and slapped stuff together really, really quickly and got to work with John Favreau, the director, and all the virtual production. And it was just the best time ever. It was so awesome. And ended up working on it for a year and a half.
Okay, yeah.
And ended up then becoming in with the marketing department of Disney.
Uh-huh.
And basically became good friends with a gentleman at Disney who really wanted to push the boundaries of marketing, and virtual reality is just about to come out. So we got developer build for the Vive, and we pitched an idea to basically do a couple of VR experiences for Jungle Book, and John loved it. So he'd just basically walk down from his office and I'd say, oh, check this out. You know, right. We took the previs and I said, you know, here you get to meet Ka the snake. Wouldn't that be awesome? And
right.
He'd be like, he'd put the headset on. He's like, all right, yeah, let's do this.
Right.
And so we then went and did the marketing of that. And then we went and did, then I took the visual effects pipelines I built at Scanline and sort of built it at Tangerine,
mm-hmm.
which is the company, Tangerine Apps. And we basically...
I love the name, by the way. That's
yeah.
good.
Yeah, I think on Jungle Book, there were a couple of other citrus fruit companies, and they were like, oh, you're one of the citrus fruit companies.
Oh,
we're
really?
Like, we're like, yeah. We're like, well, who's the other one? They're like, well, Lime is doing the audio. And we're like, oh, okay. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Lime, Tangerine, fair enough.
Yeah.
So we did a lot of stuff with 360 videos.
Yeah.
I did a thing for BFG, 360,
mm-hmm.
Working with Spielberg on that one just a tiny bit. And what else did we do? Pete's Dragon had some fun doing that.
Nice.
It basically, I discovered there was a little hole in the business model out there, which was basically you'd have VFX facilities
mm-hmm.
working on the work, and then you'd have the studios asking for content or creating things or something. And in between, there was this void between the studios and the VFX facilities. And I realized that the VFX facilities protect themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They only give out so much information to the studios. Because I would talk to my studio guy and be like, oh, you know, let's do this. And he's like, oh, I don't think that's available. I'm like, oh, it's available.
Right.
You just don't know it. They're not telling you.
Right.
And sure enough, I'd get onto the phone with the studio guy beside me and I'd be right. talking to Wetter.
Uh-huh.
And I'd be like, oh, you know, all that 360 photography you would have taken on set. And they're like, yeah.
Right.
And I'm like, well, you'd have that on a drive. And they, oh, I suppose.
Right.
I'm like, all right, well, could you make that available? Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I know.
And you
say they really, because I think that especially the larger studios, they really still like the idea of their work being proprietary, you know?
Proprietary, and they like, I mean, look, you know,
they want control.
Hats off to both sides,
yes.
You know. The studio might ask for outrageous things that mm-hmm. Harm a VFX facility.
Sure.
And a VFX facility likes to protect itself, so it keeps its cards close to its chest.
Yep.
And along comes somebody like me and I'm like, oh no, it's there. And it'd be very easy. And I'm actually just ring Richard. He'd be able to do it. And they'd
right.
be like, oh, okay, fine.
Right.
But it's not detrimental to this facility and it's not detrimental to the studio. The studio didn't know what to ask for.
It's true.
And they don't know how easy it is. And then the VFX facility have been, their guard is up for so long that they are immediately just sort of not into it.
Right.
And it's all of them, actually. I've discovered the same at, you know, all the other ones as well, because we would constantly be like, we're sort of this little facility, little tiny place that's pulling from the big boys and girls.
Yeah.
And then outputting something really, really quickly. And
yeah, I think you're right. I think their instinct is to say no.
Yeah.
And their instinct is to say no until you get past that firewall, right?
Yeah.
And you say, well, I'm only asking is for this. And they're like, oh, yeah, well, we can do that.
You know? Yeah. And I discovered that a tiny little facility they'd never heard of asking for these things and then pulling them off scared the bejesus out of them.
Yeah. Yep.
They, several facilities got quite concerned about these phone calls that the studio would be making with me on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And you could just tell. And basically, yeah, that work sort of dried up
right.
because of it, because the facilities like the, well, I won't name names, but some of them would basically say, well, we want that work.
Yes.
And you don't deserve that work.
Right.
And I'd be like, oh, yeah, but we can do it so much quicker and faster and for way less.
Yeah.
And yet it's good money for us.
Right.
And because they, you know, the commercial stuff that I had done, it just brings it in the, just sort of like, well, if we take that, we take that, we just put it in here and we do that and we just sort of render it all together and we can get it out and I can have it to you in about 4 to 6 weeks. And they're
right.
like, you know, you'd get a big facility and they're like 6 months.
Right.
Half yep. a mil dollars.
And, yeah. And easily. Sort of like, and we're going to have a massive pipeline.
Yeah. And
huge
many,
production staff.
Many emails yeah. about how incredibly difficult this is.
Right.
And I'd be like, no, it's not that difficult. No,
yeah.
I would end up doing all this stuff on my laptop or something like that. And
yeah.
It was just crazy.
Yeah. I think that sometimes we overthink things. This is not uncommon. I mean, you know, I think that, you know, even when we were, I was, you know, back in the day at Digital Domain, I think obviously things have changed a little bit based on the off-the-shelf software and stuff. But sometimes, you know, in the early days on iRobot, I think sometimes we overthought a lot about what was going on. Like, we could have made things a lot simpler, right?
Yeah.
I remember, I'm just going to, I use the same example, and it's way in the past, so I think the time has passed. But they were putting together a pipeline on Day After Tomorrow to do an ambient occlusion pipeline. Do you remember this?
Oh, I know about the icicles.
Yeah, well, the icicles. The ice balls. The icicles was one thing, but just literally to bake out ambient occlusion onto every building that was out in the thing,
right.
It was 9 months of development. Oh. It was insane. It was ridiculous. Mm. And I said, but if you ray traced it, it'd be done like in the shot. You'd be done. And they were like, ray tracing, what are you, high? You know, so, but that's what, obviously it was in 2002 or whatever, so it was a, it was,
yeah, a, I mean, the beauty about that particular show, and that really opened my eyes, was Sunny, the development of Sunny.
Oh, on iRobot, yeah.
Yeah, and nothing became more clear than when we got in trouble. Well, I don't know if we got in trouble, but the show got bigger or more, and they pulled in Weta.
Yes.
So Weta had finished on Lord of the Rings, yep. And they were hungry, hungry, hungry.
They needed some work.
They needed some work. And so they probably went hard for the show. And right. They got awarded a fairly significant section of the show.
I think they got about a third of it.
Yeah. So they got about 300 shots. We had about 550 shots or something.
Yep.
It was a pretty big show. We had 800 and 900 shots in that show. And then
that was big for back then, nowadays.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I remember distinctly where we had developed Mark Rienzo and a little bit of me, but not much. But Mark Rienzo and all the head lighting guys.
Yeah, and John Hewitt. John Hewitt was the main look dev guy for Sunny.
John and Andy, Andy, the animation director.
Andy why am I
Jones.
Blank? Jones, thank you.
And so with John, Andy Jones, John and Mark and tiny little bit of me on the side, basically.
And XDAP sort of.
And of course, yeah, and everybody
XDAP
else
was like
behind,
the big scientist behind it, right?
Yeah, so what happened is basically we couldn't ray trace Sunny.
No.
It was too expensive.
Yep.
And so,
especially because of all the glossy refractions at
the
time.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, though, is because you're doing something that is like this sort of iMac. They kept saying it's the iMac. John Nelson's like, oh, it's like it's milky, but you can see through it and all that sort of stuff. But what it turns out is there was an interview, a big sequence where Will Smith grills Sunny.
The interrogation scene.
The interrogation scene. Mm-hmm. And it's these full-on close-up shots where you've got a 20-foot robot's head up on screen,
right,
emoting a performance,
right,
where he literally needed to cry, he needed to get angry, he right. needed to be concerned. There were these three huge big shifts in that thing. And so right. I got awarded to work on that sequence,
right,
which was quite a task. And what we had to do is we ended up doing that enormous thing in Nuke whereby yeah. you get fed in all these awesome elements,
right,
but it ended up being artistic. It ended up artistically bringing in, we were changing how you saw the mouth, how much you saw into the bone, mm-hmm, on a shot-by-shot basis, even yep. to the point where we were just like looping Beziers in,
right,
and then just scooping out parts of it so it would look sexy, mm-hmm, in here. And at that point, you know, it was a big eye-opener. It was a big sort of like, well, look, it's a 2D image. We're just totally faking this thing.
Right.
But then what would happen is we would look at the dailies coming from Weta,
mm-hmm,
and they were just pouring their Lord of the Rings giant farm into this thing,
right,
and ray tracing it like no tomorrow.
Right.
And boy, did you see the difference. It
yeah.
was so different and not for the better.
No, but there was a look that was different. I mean, I think that if Weta had spent some time, or anyone for that matter, spent some time in ray tracing, especially today's technology, they could have nailed it. You know, it would have been correct, but it was a different look, and I think it was kind of cool. I love the tech. What I think was interesting about it was that pretty much it was very close to what it would be like if you actually ray traced something like that, because basically his skin was supposed to have a translucency to it, but also so you would break up things that are more distance, right?
Yeah.
Which is, you know, like a glossy refraction is what you would do that in ray tracing. But what was different about it is that it would do it correctly. It measured the distance between the cheek and whatever was behind the cheek, for example, or behind the nose and behind that.
Uh-huh.
But it would blur it a certain amount, but there was a variable in Nuke that you would do. And so basically, mm-hmm, if the robot was further away, you had to blur it less because otherwise it'd be, and then closer you'd blur it more because otherwise it'd be too clear.
Yeah.
So that was sort of one of the things that there was only that variable, honestly speaking, besides what you guys were doing to really sexy it up. But that was the only variable that was sort of not really physical is the distance from camera that the robot was. I thought it was brilliant. I thought, and this is someone who is like hardcore advocate for ray tracing. Mm-hmm. I thought like what XDAP was doing and what we were doing in RenderMan at the time was really smart.
There's in the right hands, giving somebody the control in comp, artistic interpretation can save you so much time.
Yes.
But it has to be in the right hands.
Mm-hmm.
You can put it in the wrong hands, like somebody who's like sort of, you know, just twizzling the knobs up and down.
Yep.
It'll turn into a giant mess. And what you ended up doing as a lead on the sequence, there was like 50 or 60 compers working in some of those sequences that I was leading. There, you would end up with, you're just like, okay, just take it, throw it out, feed the two main elements in.
Right.
Let's just have a look and step back for a second and see.
Right.
And then they'd sort of go, oh, well, see, this is why I did this. And I was like, yeah, but you did that and you did that. And then you went down a rabbit hole.
Right, yeah.
And then you ended up, you know, needing to pull back on that.
Right.
And so you're just like, look, just take a step back and do something simple. You would avoid that. But like I said, you know, there's two worlds in visual effects. It's the mechanical, artistically ray-traced perfection. Mm-hmm. And then there's the creative interpretation, and those two things still exist just as strong today as they did before.
They do. And I think that but a lot more today is that the people that are more artistic are handed a ray tracer these days, right?
Yes.
And so the ray tracing is still part the what's different now is that the people that are more artistic, they don't even have to think about what the ray tracing is doing.
Right.
Before, we were obsessing about its accuracy and is this physically correct and is it photoreal and blah, 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 blah. Now we just, that's actually taken for granted.
Yeah.
And the artist can go back to being an artist again, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that's kind of cool. But okay, but let's go back to your company. So obviously you said you were doing some stuff and you said some of that work sort of dried up because in certain cases, because of the way that you were interacting with somebody's studio.
Well, one of the best things I did, I have a friend who worked, in the commercial advertising business, and he got a job to work for the Los Angeles Olympic Committee.
Oh, yeah. Nice.
So they went to go and make Los Angeles woo the IOC to award the Olympic Games. And so I convinced him to come and work with us, and he said, I can't wait. It sounds awesome. And we worked for them for about 9 months, culminating in us going to Switzerland and meeting the IOC president and going and helping building the room and building a whole virtual reality experience for all the visiting, you know, IOC members to come down and experience sporting. So basically, you know, when I left Scanline, I wanted to do something new.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, I have learned so much in those 4 years. It's been like a little too much, like how to run a company, how to pay the accounts, how to look for a space, you know, and how to do VR. So basically I haven't comped in literally 4 years.
Yeah.
And you know, the same skills apply, but I've applied it all to Game Engine.
Right.
And I find Game Engine stuff to be so awesome, and it's getting even more awesome.
Yep.
And I was thinking, you know, I guess there's a mentality when you get so ingrained and stuck in these weird little worlds when you work on a movie, you can just disappear literally for years into a film, and when you come out, you're like, oh, you know, Seinfeld's still playing,
right?
There was sort of a poo-poo attitude towards games. You know, there's two rivals in those worlds as they came along. And we were always like, oh, game engines will never compete with visual effects world. And that's probably true to some degree, although I'm sure it'll get very, very close. Games are certainly getting more and more amazing, but by the same token, so are visual effects.
Mm-hmm.
But I noticed that at some point my brain didn't care whether they were any different. I actually went, you know what, I have...
There's different use cases too.
I remember we did this VR experience for Jungle Book. You actually put it on. It was one of the first times that the VR headset. This is like 4 years ago.
Right.
The Vive had, we were showing it on a developer build.
Right.
And we toured it all across the country. So it went to 10 cities.
Okay.
They set up a crew to actually build the little experience.
Right.
And then they traveled it up and down. And basically you put the headset on and people would line up and you'd basically become Mowgli. You mm-hmm. stand on the tree in the film.
Right.
And it was the tree in the film. And Ka comes down, the snake,
right.
and meets you and talks to you. And it's Scarlet's voice
right.
and all that sort of stuff. And I remember we went over here to Century City just to check it out, make sure it was going okay.
Right.
And there was a lady standing beside me while I was just watching people have fun in the experience. And I said, oh, are you standing here with waiting for your son? And he's like, yes, yes, he's going to try. And I said, oh, you should give it a go. And she was like, oh, no, no, I can't. I can't do it. I'm sick. I'm suffering from multiple sclerosis. I don't think I should do it. And I was like, oh, well, look, why don't you just go and give it a go anyway? And if you don't like it, just take the headset off. Just pull it off your head.
Right.
And at least you can try. And she goes, oh, you think so? She would have been like 60 something.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah, yeah, go and give it a go. Trust me. I you'll be fine. You won't fall over or anything like that. It'll be mm-hmm. fine. So she went over and she tried it. And she experienced it for 2 minutes. Afterwards, she came over and gave me a hug.
Right.
And I was just like,
right.
Okay. My brain's just changed.
Right.
You know, I just made one person who would never have done something
yeah.
do something, and they thought it was so awesome that they thought it would.
Yeah, she would never have had that opportunity if you didn't.
Yeah, and when you make a movie and it gets seen by millions of people, I don't know if they like it or not. You
right.
know, just, so you'd spend so long making it. And
right.
when I did this one little thing and it affected this one person, I was like, you know what? I just need to make these experiences with one person liking it, and that's all I care about.
Awesome.
Providing that somebody wants to pay us to do it.
Well, that's great. I mean, obviously, it sounds like you guys are doing some really interesting stuff. I mean, I love the fact, what I just you know, we've got a little bit more time, although we're about an hour, actually, believe it or not. But no, it's good.
I talk too much.
No, it's great. I want to know, you know, there is life after visual effects, right? There's a very interesting life after visual effects in a way that I think the what we have learned working in feature films or visual effects is really important and really great. But you can apply those skills and do new things that are really great. And I think that's something that I think a lot of the people that listen to this would be interested in knowing. Like, what were, you know, you learned how to start a business, right? That's kind of fun, right? You learned new technology. You learned new mediums. You learned new kinds of clients and customers in different ways, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think I was always heading down this path, whether I liked it or not. What I've learned has been amazing. VR, I've done a lot of VR. We actually built virtual tools for building. I became really fascinated with making traditional films, but using VR as a tool to get to that end.
Okay.
Although we do VR, and we're doing a couple of VR projects right now and doing AR. Basically, we do visual effects, AR, VR, whatever comes our way, apps, that sort of thing. And I became obsessed with basically using VR as a tool, because quite frankly, this whole sort of, you know, we're all going to use computers with VR is all rubbish.
Right.
None of that's going to happen. But I do believe that I was listening to Alex talk the other day about VR, and he was using it for art direction for doing
Alex McDowell?
Alex Nice.
Alex Nice, yes, yes.
I found that to be amazing. And I actually went to a Netflix film back in September.
Okay.
And we developed these VR tools, and I took them out to production. And this classic example of when you're working in production or working on set, you're working with the art department, you're working with stunts, you're working with the directors, and these new directors that were working, we did this New Orleans film. They were super awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some big shoots. I mean, it was a big film. I don't know the budget, but it was big.
Mm-hmm.
And they're building the set at the end. They were building a couple of sets that are $500,000 minimum dollar sets.
Right.
So these $500,000 sets. And they were trying to figure out the height of the ceiling.
Right.
And so I went over to the art director and said, give me your CAD files. So I took the CAD files, put them in VR, put the directors in the VR headset.
Yep.
And then actually pre-vised it. So pre-vised it, they were able to move the characters around, block out shots.
Yep.
And then they were actually like, the ceiling needs to be 2 feet lower. And so they dropped the ceiling down. So the production designer, Naomi, came over afterwards and she was just like, that's insane. What you just did, like, you just saved $100,000.
Yes.
You
know?
And I was just like, well, that's easy. That only took me a few days to do that.
I understand. And this is exactly, I am so much agree with you. I can't tell you, because it's not just what you described is fantastic and has an amazing use case in virtual production or even just production. Like you said, you help visualize the set for them, right? But that's the same exact scenario that an architect could go through. Can you imagine? Like,
yeah.
If you're designing a building and you're like, if I had seen this in VR, I would never have built it that way.
We're actually doing that.
Right.
You know, I mean, what we did for the Olympics, so with the Olympics, we did about five projects with them. The first one was a commercial, but they did a big pitch where all the venues around Los Angeles get to have plans and all that sort of stuff. The planning involving in the Olympics and just learning about sporting and that particular
right.
thing was an eye-opening experience.
Right.
And some of the venues were already there and some of the venues weren't there.
Okay.
So one of the ones that wasn't there was the Rams Stadium being built at Inglewood.
Right.
Now, it was going to be built in 2 years or 3 years' time.
Right.
And they had already started digging a giant hole, but they wanted to pitch the fact that this insanely amazing stadium that would be world-class, better and bigger than any stadium in the world, mm-hmm. could house the opening and closing ceremonies of the games.
Right.
So we went to the CAD company, right. said, give us the CAD files, and we built it in VR and had an experience where we did a volume capture of Casey Wasserman, the guy who was representing Los Angeles in the bid.
Right.
We actually volume captured him, and he takes you on a tour of this stadium.
Right.
And so all the IOC members, we had, I think, you know, maybe a world first, we had 10 Rift
Wow.
Headsets running
simultaneously.
All simultaneously.
Wow.
They had to be in sync.
Right.
Because what happens is the IOC fly in for 2 days
right.
and they get taken on this whirlwind tour of all the venues.
Right.
And when you go to these different venues, they wanted to either see what the venue would look like mm-hmm. or see how it was going to be changed to house the event.
Right.
So we did an AR experience where we built these special cases. And we did this using the Tango technology that Google had.
Yes. Yeah,
you
yeah.
had the ability to go to the Colosseum down here.
Uh-huh.
Now, right now they're working on it, but 2 years ago there was no box suites and the athlete field was considerably not there.
Right.
And so they held out this device that was tracking the real world.
Right.
And they were able to see, we built the athletic track.
So
and
this is
removed
so you,
seats.
So it was through like an iPad or
a large Tango device.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we built these custom devices, and you basically held. So all these ISC guys or sort of and girls are walking around, holding it up, and they're seeing the $450 million renovation being done for all the suites. Then they're
right.
seeing how the chairs are going to be pulled out and seeing,
right.
and they're walking around on the real venue.
Right.
And then at one point we had it out at the Equestrian Center, which was out in the valley there.
Yeah.
And the Equestrian Center was going to be built as a sort of freestanding temporary structure.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just a dusty bowl.
Right.
And we have this photography of all these IOC members running around the horse jumps.
Right.
Holding our devices because it's real world tracking.
Right, yeah.
So being able to apply that kind of technology, that real world tracking, because the Tango is amazing tracking.
Right.
And then we then did this VR experience where you could see this Ram Stadium years before it was even built.
Right.
And standing as if you're really there.
How long ago was this?
We did it. This is 18. It was last year, but we were working on it the year before,
right.
leading up to last year. So we flew to Switzerland in July last year to take the final VR experience over
okay.
there. But we did experiences here in Los Angeles, and
right.
before that, we did a commercial for them.
Wow.
So that was definitely a highlight. And now we're working with a similar thing. So we're
right.
working on a stadium and visualizing it while they build it.
Right.
And it's just they're able to get on it and we're able to put people in on the ground and we're building a football thing.
Wow.
And it's amazing what you can do now. And for VR really has that place. It's really good for certain things.
Yep.
AR, I think, is potentially the one that can go out to the masses. We're doing.
Yeah, but I don't necessarily see people wearing a bunch of gear on their face.
No. Not that AR. Just holding your phone up.
Oh, yeah, like AR kit and all that stuff. Because Tango really started it. You're right. Yeah. I mean, I remember Project Tango when Google said it, I was like, what is this? And it seemed fascinating. Now they have AR kit and everything else on the iPhone, and they have the same thing on the Android phones, which is basically based on Tango. But yeah, just being able to overlay a tracking data that you have.
Yeah, and right? I think, you know, it's kind of annoying to do it, you know, magazines and all that sort of stuff. Right. And you don't want to walk around with a phone in your hand, all that sort of stuff. But you can do some really interesting things.
Why not? We do it anyway.
Well, yeah, but you're not going to really walk around sort of, doing things that are essential for that. But there are some really interesting things, like going to a concert and getting lost at a festival.
And
being able to just sort of pull out a three-dimensional map, and the three-dimensional map tracks all your friends.
Oh, that's
so
cool.
It shows you where your friends are on the map that's three-dimensionally out in front of you.
Right.
So it's almost like it tags everybody. And you're like, so you're no longer at a festival losing somebody. You can see that, you know, Andy's over here and all that sort of stuff. And that, I think, is really, really cool. So
that
it's something
is.
You bring out. It's a tool. You use it. You're like, oh, it solves a problem. You stick it back in your pocket. You go off.
Right.
I think it really does have some potential really there. And that's really cool. So I think this technology coming out is really useful, and certain tools. It's like, you know, you use V-Ray for ray tracing over here. You do a very specific task.
Yep.
Then you use AR over here. It's a very specific task. A lot of these things come out and everybody's like, oh my God, it's going to replace computers. And I'm like, no. Let's not be silly.
No, it's got a task here. I think that's a great analogy for it. And I think that's an important one. And I think that we're only just starting to figure out what that task is.
Yeah.
I think, you know, what you explained on Jungle Book is great, but not as useful as your, you know, Olympics thing, right? The Olympics thing had a task that's like, this is something very specific that's going to help people visualize what it's going to be like and help make decisions, right?
Yeah. And showing buildings that didn't exist.
Right. And that's huge. I think that those are way more important tasks than giving you a VR experience. I think that that's really, really cool.
Yeah, and when you apply it to all those things, all of a sudden, you know, you're mentioning, you know, there's life after visual effects is one way of looking at it.
Right.
You realize that if you have these skills, I mean, you need to learn game engines for starters.
Sure.
You know, learn Unity, learn Unreal, all those sorts of ones. And, you know, God, those things are like unraveling. I always knew 3D, but I was always like, you know, when I'm in comp, I'm a traditional drawer. I like to sort of like comp is so big. 3D is so big. Once you go down that rabbit hole, you just really have to dive big.
Right.
People dedicate their entire lives to learning that world.
Right.
But when it came to game engines, it's almost like if you've got a V, one's comp up here, one's 3D over here, the V down the bottom is the game engine. It sort of comes down, it's different from all of it because you can't work in the same level of quality or the same polygon count or don't care about certain things. We're getting there with this sort of new, we can do ray tracing in real time and all that sort of stuff, but there's still...
I'll show you some technology after this.
There's still so much that needs to happen to lead you to real-time ray tracing.
Right.
Like, I'm sure that the numbers are going to be crunching and doing amazing things, but you know what? I bet you any money the model needs to be 50,000 polygons because if you feed a visual effects
With ray tracing, and we did real-time ray tracing with 300 billion polygons.
Right, but was it as efficient if it was one of the 50,000 polygon one?
Actually, it doesn't matter. That's the whole point about ray tracing.
Oh, sounds like you're going to show me afterwards.
Scanline rendering is actually less efficient with polygons. You can do a lot more with ray tracing in terms of actual polygons. Now, there's a balance, right? There's certain strengths in one and certain strengths in the other, and that's why people make hybrids. There is a lot of different ways that you can look at it. Not to necessarily say that real-time ray tracing is happening today. It's just 2018 is the year that I think real-time ray tracing became a word.
Yeah, a possibility.
Right? You know, a possibility. And I think that people are going to look back at, like, that's that moment that happened, right?
Yeah.
And right now there's some setbacks in terms of, you know, where that technology is going. Not on our side, but in terms of some other things. But it's still happening.
Yeah,
but there's a lot of in-betweens between rasterization and ray tracing. There's a lot of in-between states, and I can show you some really cool stuff in that, especially in VR.
And then I find, though, what happens is you'll get a job that has an end result, and you're like, all right, I can see this end result. And that end result might be a platform. It might be right now we're working on a project that goes to a phone.
Okay.
But, you know, you sort of lay down the law. You're like, is it going to be a really good phone?
Right, because those are really high resolution.
Yeah, because it needs to be a really good phone in order to do what you're asking it to do.
Right.
Because, you know, you have the client come in and they sort of, we want to do all of this stuff. And you're like, you know that a desktop system would struggle to do this. And they're like, oh, and we want it on a phone. You're like, okay, we need to lay down some strong laws here. But I found that... what happens is the piece of technology comes out, we can do real-time ray tracing, and then you actually look into real-time ray tracing and you realize that it's, when they're talking about it in those big conferences and running around saying we can do real-time ray tracing, and you're looking at ILM XLab's sort of demonstration, all that sort of stuff, it was so custom done and so specific and built like this insane system to run it. So it is possible. But then when you actually want to apply it to your day-to-day job, it's not possible, and it's probably only a few years out. But what you can do is you can take pieces of it, and you bring pieces down. So what it does is it brings your job up to a certain level.
Right.
So the ability to just simply run on a phone a million particles doing something now is actually going to run smooth, because there's a lot of stuff to be done with volume captures.
Mm-hmm.
And volume captures are incredibly inefficient.
Yeah.
They are awful sort of to work with. We basically, when you're working in VR, you've got to constantly hit that sort of 90 FPS or 110, or it's 90 times two eyes. It's,
right.
And now you can split it off and all that sort of stuff. You've got a certain level you can work in. So what we do is you work in a certain level, and then you put the volume capture into it, and it just destroys everything you've done.
Right.
And you end up making what you had, a nice comfortable little sort of like cushion of sitting in, you now have to destroy your work just simply to run the volume.
Right.
And so now we're doing that and running it on a phone.
Yeah.
So 3 years ago, we were running it on a desktop and struggling. Now we're running it on a phone and struggling.
Right.
So it's interesting that I find that the technology trickles down, but it's not immediately accessible in all these sorts of things. But it's fascinating. It's super awesome times.
Yeah, it's great. And it's, I think it's really great that you're involved in that, because I think that's kind of what I think is important right now, is to see all that stuff and to be involved in that and trying new things and exploring new avenues. And it's, you know, I don't care about credits in a movie anymore.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's not what that motivates me. In fact, now when I see a sea of names and they just put like, they just put like artists, and then it's five columns, and
I feel sorry for the guys.
I feel bad.
I feel sorry for the guys, because I think DD, we did a really good job for a long time of doing of
breaking down
all that sort of stuff, and then ILM came along and just went, this person and then those people, and you're just sort of like, oh man.
You worked for 2 years on this movie, and you're just in a sea of names.
I think they did it for, you know, they're sort of like, hey, we treat everybody equal.
Right.
And I'm like, yeah, but you're treating everybody equal in such a way that when you're working those long hours and these long things, and maybe you're paying reasonable, you go, okay, at least I'll get that title.
Yeah.
And it's like a chink in your armor or a scouting badge that you get.
Yeah.
And it was good and it was cool. And when you achieve those sorts of things, I was blessed with my career in films to actually weirdly early on achieve all the goals I could possibly imagine.
Right.
Culminating in 2010 or 11 when Brian asked me to come over and help him out on Hereafter and work with Clint Eastwood. And we got insanely, amazingly nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah.
And I was just like, that's insane. And
right.
So that whole thing happened, and then after all that happened, you're just sort of like, I think I need to just change what I'm doing. I need to reevaluate what I was doing, and I really enjoy getting back to a 12-year-old me and drawing on a computer and getting excited about what I was doing.
Trying new stuff.
Yeah. I found
an endless world of new things you're going to be finding.
Yeah. I found actually running a company, all of a sudden I would get huge amount of pleasure in doing some roto on a job. I would sit there and roto a job. And before I would never do that because I did that a long time ago. You're always comping when you're rotoing when you're a flame artist.
But right.
The reason being is because you had been awarded the job from nothing. Nobody had handed you the job.
Right.
You had got off your butt. You had gone out there. You had found the client. You had convinced the client. Sometimes a lot of these jobs, the job doesn't actually exist. You convince the client that the job should exist.
Right.
And which is a whole different kettle of worms. It's like one thing is they've made a movie and they need somebody to do the work. Yep. It's another one to go to a studio and say, you should make this movie. And they're like, why? And you're like, because it'll be cool. And they're like, okay. And it's so much more rewarding when they do that.
Yeah, that's a very different experience.
And so when you're doing roto, you're like, oh, man, this is just the best roto I've ever done.
Right, because it's your roto.
It's my roto.
Right, and for your thing.
Yeah, and yeah. I'm the one that worked hard to get it.
You're not rotoing it because someone messed up on set.
No. Well, yeah.
Sometimes you are.
Well, it's because I messed up, I guess. But
but you own it. You know, yeah. There's some experience. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. That's awesome. I want to make sure we have time to show you a few things before
sure.
we go to lunch. But before we go, like, is there any other, you know, obviously tell people about your company, Tangerine Apps, I think is what it's called, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. We only wanted Tangerine, but I'm afraid the bank that just went bankrupt was called ING.
Yes.
They went bankrupt as we were starting, but they had bought the word tangerine all across all idents, all right. across. So they had bought the business name. They had bought the website.
Is it available now?
No. No, they haven't. So they basically moved it up to Canada, and they moved tangerine. The ING became tangerine.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, man. So, you know, and my business partner was like, well, we're going to be designing apps. And I'm like, all right, yeah, but apps, I mean, it doesn't really explain what we do. So now we sort of dropped the word apps, but it's written in the website. So
okay, so tangerine.
Yes.
But so that how big is your company at this point? You said 4.5 years, right? Which is pretty awesome.
Yeah. Well, you know what you learn when you run a business is how to survive.
Yeah.
And the best business model that I have come across is that you have a very tiny core.
Yep.
And because we're in Los Angeles and because all the work went away from Los Angeles, mm-hmm. Los Angeles has this insane pool of freelancers.
Yes.
Very talented.
Yeah.
30-year veterans
yep.
in the business that I hope enjoy freelancing out there.
Yeah.
And that allows us to be able to call up at a moment's notice amazing people.
Yeah.
So our business model is very small people. Very yeah. small minimum number.
Yeah.
We got a studio over in El Segundo, so
okay.
we can expand to like 12 to 15 people when the projects come in.
Right.
But that's basically. So we get a
awesome.
Project come in, we expand up two or three projects at a time.
Right.
And they vary. They vary from just sort of old visual effects jobs,
right.
Films, Netflix, all that sort of stuff, to doing VR for traditional productions.
Right.
We get all sorts of crazy, interesting ideas that come our way. And that's the beauty of running a business is being able to pivot and just say, hey, let's do this. Mm-hmm. Let's pull this. Let's get a robot arm in for doing miniatures and run it rigged to the VR.
Right.
Just so much fun to do that stuff.
I love it.
Even if it doesn't come off, you know, which is, you know.
I love it.
When you're running a business, you realize 80% of the jobs don't come off.
Right.
And so jobs you think are concrete and are there and you're working on them don't happen. And then jobs that you didn't even know were right beside you or just sort of pop, there they are.
Right.
Right now I'm working on an opera.
Awesome.
So, you know, I can't say who the client is or what it is, but it's an opera. And I just jumped at this opportunity. I was like, when is that ever going to happen
yeah.
in your career unless you suddenly start becoming a theater director?
Right, right, right.
And so basically we're working with theater director and we're designing an opera in AR.
That's awesome.
That's crazy.
That's so cool. Well, awesome. Well, thank you so much for doing this, Joe. I really appreciate it. This has been a great story.
Thanks for having me on. I didn't know I'd had anything to say of any importance. But.
Oh, I think you do.
Okay.
Absolutely. No, I think this is really good for people to hear some of those stories because I think people need to know about the opportunities that are out there that, you know, if those things don't, you know, the knowledge you develop in visual effects does not pigeonhole you into doing things. There's so many bigger opportunities out there to do so many more interesting things.
And it's so much fun. And you just got to basically have the faith to just do it.
Yeah.
You know, I've been self-taught my whole career.
Yep.
So never did a Unity course. Now 4 years into Unity.
Right.
I my choice of software for 3D is Modo.
Right.
Became a huge fan of Modo because it just did everything in one box.
Right.
And of course Nuke for 15, 20 years or whatever it was. And Flame and stuff. So once you know those sorts of basics, it doesn't really matter what the project is, providing that you're having fun doing it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then of course you've got to then pay the bills. So paying the bills on the project. So, you know, if you get a job that comes along and it's super not exciting or sexy,
right.
Then you look at the good that comes out of that job.
Sure.
So, you know, or it's paying the bills or, you know, we were
or it's going to foster our future relationship.
Yeah. Or things like that, or, you know, stave off the bankruptcy. No, yeah. Just kidding. it's all fun. And so I was very nervous into taking this step out and working for myself.
Right.
And I never want to look back.
Yeah.
I would regret having to go and work at another facility. And, you know, maybe it will happen in the future because you just can't tell with these businesses.
Sure.
But I find it very, very exciting.
Yeah.
Every day.
It sounds like you're staying very limber, too, in terms of what you're doing.
Yeah, you have to.
Yeah.
Stay limber. Fingers in all the pies.
Yeah, exactly. Well, cool. Well, thanks so much, Joe. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.